an aggressive terrier, perhaps, to keep away all the unwanted visitors who interrupt my work.
I can't abide people who dislike dogs, said Lady Emily. I am especially suspicious of those who prefer cats.
She peered as if Beatrice might be guilty.
There is something too malleable about them, don't you think?
I believe our mayoress, Mrs. Fothergill, has two rather elegant long-haired Siamese, said Daniel.
A very pushing sort of woman, said Lady Emily. However, I will hold my tongue tomorrow in order to secure Miss Nash's position.
Not that your position in the school is not secure, added Agatha,
but Lady Emily hosts an annual tea with the school governors, the headmaster and staff, and some of our other dignitaries. We thought it would be a lovely Sunday afternoon introduction to ensure your welcome to the community.
Of course, we did not expect you to be so young, said Lady Emily.
Beatrice felt a flush spread across her neck and cheeks as the question of her age, which would not, of course, be asked, hung in the air.
I am 23, she said, looking directly at Lady Emily. I hope I am therefore sufficiently advanced into spinsterhood.
I am sure there is no question that you are, said Agatha. Positively ancient, said Daniel. Don't you agree, Hugh?
That isn't what I meant at all, said Agatha.
A more wrinkled physiognomy and grey hair might have been expected, said Hugh, but I am sure a few weeks of our local grammar pupils will achieve the desired appearance. I believe the real problem is that Lady Emily and Mrs. Kent present such figures of youth that anyone your age must appear a mere slip of a girl, said Mr. Tillingham.
You are being absurd, dear friend, said Lady Emily, but she looked a little pinker in the face.
He is being a writer, said Daniel. All writers must tell truth to beauty. Obviously, poets are compelled to produce excesses of hyperbole, said Hugh. I imagine writers merely exaggerate.
Daniel laughed, and Beatrice saw Mr. Tillingham's face flicker with annoyance before he too relaxed into a chuckle.
And thus, with a blunt saw, we are crudely and cruelly dissected by the medical man, said Mr. Tillingham.
Well, regardless of age, I am sure Miss Nash will present herself as a modest, dignified woman and show that we have made the right decision, said Agatha.
I shall be sure to wear my ugliest dress, said Beatrice.
Plain will do, said Lady Emily in a severe tone. We just don't need another spectacle like our French mistress and her preposterous silk dresses.
To be fair, Miss Clover is not an Englishwoman, said Agatha. It is our good fortune to have a real Frenchwoman.
True, said Lady Emily. But I'm thankful Miss Nash's family is of impeccable English lineage.
Actually, my mother was American, said Beatrice, before she could stop herself.
She clamped her lips closed in order to resist adding that her father had been disowned by the Marbleys, and had disowned them in return for as long as possible.
An American? Said Lady Emily, in a tone of horrified surprise.
How delightful, said Daniel. Lady Emily is a great admirer of all things American. Is she not, Mr. Tillingham?
Of course, said Tillingham.
He did not look terribly happy at being reminded of his own citizenship. Beatrice now recognized that his careful articulation bore deliberately little trace of any accent.
My father is English, she said. Though after my mother died, he could never seem to be happy here.
Ah, the mysteries of the human heart, said Mr. Tillingham.
He raised a hand into the air, as if about to conduct an unseen orchestra, and everyone paused, as probably he intended, thought Beatrice, in order to await a bon mot from the great mind.
For I long ago found a home and a safe harbour in this tiny corner of England, and I can never seem to be happy anywhere else.
And we consider you quite one of us, Mr. Tillingham, said Lady Emily. I assure you, I no longer even think of you as American.
Mr. Tillingham is in great demand among the local hostesses, said Agatha to Beatrice. He is quite pestered with invitations.
I must be ruthless in declining, or I would never dine by my own comfortable fireside, said Mr. Tillingham.
The public acknowledgement of one's literary contributions is of course gratifying,
but the burden of reputation can be heavy at times.
Good thing you don't have to suffer under such a burden with your poetry, Daniel, said Hugh. I shall pray for you to remain unpublished.
I have broad shoulders, said Daniel. Bring on the fame and the laurels.
You may joke, boys, said Mr. Tillingham, but wait until yet another local squire leans across the dinner table to ask you loudly whether he might have read anything you've written.
I know something of what you mean, said Beatrice. My father was often asked to explain who he was and what kind of things he wrote. He was always patient. There was a polite pause, and Beatrice froze, realizing with horror that they thought she was referring to Mr. Tillingham's earlier failure to recollect her father's name.
"I, alas, am not as patient, perhaps, as your father," said Mr. Tillingham, and gave her a smile that eliminated any tension.
Beatrice could have kissed him for his unexpected graciousness.
"I like to respond that I do not write for the Farmer's Almanac, and so cannot dare to hope that the gentleman has read any of my meagre oeuvre."
"It is far more polite to admit that one doesn't read," said Lady Emily. "Who has the time? Of course, we have all of Mr. Tillingham's works in our library. I always give your latest volume Pride of Place next to my drawing-room chair, Mr. Tillingham. I have a special gold bookmark with a Fortuny silk tassel."
"I am touched," said Mr. Tillingham. "If Mr. Tillingham prefers to dine in his own home, we should make an effort to invite him less often, aunt," said Hugh. "It would be terrible to think that we distracted him."
He smiled, but Beatrice detected that Hugh was not altogether joking. She wondered why he didn't like the great man. "I trust Mr. Tillingham knows he is at liberty to come to dinner any time, and to decline dinner whenever he feels like it," said Agatha. "We do not stand on ceremony with those we consider family," she turned to Beatrice and added, "Mr. Tillingham is always writing to me to inquire about the boys, and has taken a kind interest in Daniel's poetry."
"To help along the next generation of young writers and poets is a duty I consider both sacred and rewarding," said Mr. Tillingham. "I am hoping, Daniel, that you will come to dinner and bring me some more poems to read."
He raised a thick eyebrow and gave Daniel a conspiratorial smile.
"I'm afraid they're hardly in a fit state," said Daniel, maintaining a languid air of indifference. "But I'm trying to wrestle some life into one or two pieces."
"I believe Miss Nash also writes," said Hugh.
"Oh, no," said Beatrice, flustered by an urgent desire to have the great writer offer a smile of interest towards her and the competing wish to heed Agatha Kent's injunction. "I mean, I have spent the past year editing my father's personal letters in the hopes of publishing a small volume." She looked at Mr. Tillingham, whose face showed a hint of relief.
"Collecting and sorting such material is an admirable project for a daughter," he said. "I'm sure it will be of great interest to your father's friends and family, and at least it is a sober endeavor and not some flighty female novel."
"Perhaps Miss Nash also wishes to write a novel," asked Hugh.
"Miss Nash will be fully occupied by her vocation as a teacher, and will have no interest in such frivolous pursuits," said Lady Emily. Agatha Kent looked at Beatrice with an eyebrow raised in mute hope. "My teaching duties will be all my concern," said Beatrice, bitterly disappointed, but resigned to the practical.
"Thank the Lord," said Mr. Tillingham. "There is a great fashion for encouraging young women, especially American women, to think they can write, and I have received several slightly hysterical requests to read such charming manuscripts."
"And did you?" asked Daniel.
"Goodness, no. I would rather cut off my right hand," said Mr. Tillingham. "I delegated my secretary to compose her own diplomatic replies and to consign the offending pages to the kitchen stove."
"I thought you were great friends with that American woman who insists on writing even though her position and fortune make it quite unnecessary," said Lady Emily.
"The lady of whom you speak is in a category by herself," said Mr. Tillingham. "She does possess a fastidious eye for the narrow milieu of which she writes. I cannot fault her competence nor argue with her considerable success."
"Plus, she's very generous, I hear," said Daniel.
Doesn't she come down and take you out in her enormous motor car?
Daniel, said his aunt.
Mr. Tillingham waved his hand to indicate his lack of offence.
I assure you, dear boy, that I am quite capable of accepting friends' generosity and still telling them exactly what I think of their art,
said Mr. Tillingham.
Indeed, I wish it were otherwise, for I have lost friends and chased away a great love or two in my time with what some of them described as my brutish candour.
To Beatrice's great surprise, he pulled out his large silk pocket square and dabbed at his eyes, which were filling with tears.
I would never describe you as brutish, said Daniel.
He turned to the room at large and added, But the last group of poems I showed to Mr. Tillingham was so thoroughly and precisely dismantled that all I had left was a single couplet.
It is a curse, but I have never been able to speak anything but the truth when it comes to the written word, said Mr. Tillingham. I believe your father felt the same way, my dear.
You do remember him, said Beatrice.
It is coming to me, said Mr. Tillingham.
Is it possible that he wrote an absolutely scathing review of my very first play?
I believe he did review it, said Beatrice, blushing.
Well, it wasn't the only one, to be sure, said Tillingham. But I do remember his analysis was astute enough for me to feel unable to write my usual long and detailed rebuttal.
Thank you, said Beatrice.
I will look for his book as soon as I get home, added Tillingham. And you must come to tea and show me one or two of your father's more interesting letters.
Beatrice felt tears sting the backs of her eyes, and she dug her fingernails into her palms to keep from betraying her gratitude. Mr. Tillingham patted her hand, and Beatrice felt Lady Emily's astonishment.
Wonderful, said Agatha. Remind me to make sure the headmaster and the vicar also extend invitations.
It is an act of common decency to take turns in relieving the loneliness of the parish's lady spinsters, said Lady Emily. Whenever I'm home, I have two elderly sisters in for bridge on Tuesdays. Perhaps you play, Miss Nash.
Beatrice struggled to find an acceptable evasion, as she was rather proud of her bridge skills.
On Tuesdays, Miss Nash will be tutoring some of the grammar boys, said Agatha smoothly. I had not wanted to impose on you any more, dear Lady Emily, but an invitation to tea from you, issued publicly in the middle of the garden party, would be just the thing to make our little project unassailable and stop Mrs. Fothergill's intrigues.
Well, if you think it would help, said Lady Emily, looking somewhat mollified, I would willingly endure absolute hardship to put Mrs. Fothergill in her place.
As the dinner gong rang, Beatrice caught sight of Hugh and Daniel exchanging a smothered grin. She suppressed a smile of her own and thought that she would willingly hear herself compared to a hardship just as long as she did not have to join Lady Emily's parade of spinsters.
Chapter 5 The girl who knocked at Beatrice's bedroom door the next morning did not seem strong enough to carry the heavy tray on which rested a cup of tea in a florid porcelain cup and a heavy jug of hot water for the washstand. She was hollow in the cheeks and narrow-shouldered, her hair pulled back mercilessly into a single braid. Her dress and apron hung loosely, and her boots looked comically large-laced onto such scrawny ankles.
"Cup of tea, miss?" she said. "And I'm to tell you breakfast is under a cover below, because Mrs. Turbury's gone to church at 8, and she hopes you won't expect to set God aside for people who use a Sabbath for sleeping late."
"Why didn't you wake me?" asked Beatrice.
"I tried, miss, but you didn't want to stir, and I took the tea away cold."
She put the tray on the floor, transferred the jug to the washstand, and brought the tea, her lips clamped in concentration to keep the cup from wobbling on its gilded saucer. Even when Beatrice took the tea from her, the girl did not look up, but merely turned away to the tray.
"I've never failed to wake up," said Beatrice, taking a long gulp of hot tea. "I suppose I was tired from travelling."
She was used to the pale dawn hours, the bird's thin choir accompanying her waking thoughts of her father. Curiously, she did not feel guilty for sleeping so late into the hot morning, and if she was tired from the travel and all the new impressions around her, at least it was a different kind of exhaustion than she had felt all year.
more a good physical tiredness and less the enervating lassitude that comes with hopelessness.
"Mr. Puddlecum never got up before noon on a Sunday," said the girl. She shuffled her absurd boots and her cheeks flushed an unflattering red.
"What's your name?" asked Beatrice. The girl gave her a sideways glance and seemed to be gathering her courage to speak.
"I'm so sorry, miss. I'll call out louder next time if you want," she said. "But if you get up early, Mrs. Turber will make me go to church too, and then it's very hard to get through all the polishing before lunch. And I get Sunday afternoon off, but only if I'm all done, and my mum is poorly and needs me, and my name's Abigail."
"How old are you, Abigail?"
13, miss. "Or almost, but I'm strong for my age."
"Well, Abigail, I prefer to go to later services anyway, and I'm not going today at all because I'm to be introduced at a garden party this afternoon, and I'm being kept quite hidden from view until then."
"I can bring your breakfast up if you like," said Abigail. "It's a hard-boiled egg and toast, some cold bacon and tomatoes."
"I'd like them packed in a napkin," said Beatrice. "I think I'll take a ride on my bicycle and eat my breakfast on the beach." Abigail seemed too surprised to reply, and Beatrice's smile only served to make her look more alarmed.
"Run along and pack them up for me," added Beatrice.
"I'll be quite out of your way, and you can polish silver all morning."
"A bicycle, miss," said Abigail. "That's a grand thing."
Sunday dinner, served promptly after the noon church service, was the one meal a week to be taken in Mrs. Turber's own dining room.
"I won't be in to tea, Mrs. Turber," said Beatrice,
pushing the gristle from a leathery slice of beef under a piece of cabbage and neatly setting her knife and fork down on the plate. She was sitting wedged between the heavy oak table and a large dark sideboard. The sideboard wore a crocheted doily, as did the backs of the dining chairs, a small curio cabinet, and several plant stands containing fat ferns and bulbous, rubbery plants for which Beatrice had no name. The table was also decked in a crocheted white tablecloth over a green baize square, which in turn protected a heavy red damask cloth that was never removed. The furniture was further protected by festoons of chintz and pleated muslin over the one small window, and the room was as airless as a vacuum. Beatrice sipped her glass of water and prayed for patience as the gilded parlour clock on the mantelpiece made a ticking sound at agonizingly slow intervals.
"Well, it's a good thing I didn't make the Victoria sponge this morning, then," said Mrs. Turber. "That would have been a waste."
"I think Mrs. Kent told you that I'm required up at Lady Emily's," said Beatrice.
"I thank the good Lord that I've never been one for putting on airs," said Mrs. Turber. "Some people about this town." "Well, I don't blame Lady Emily for being taken in," she scowled, pressing her lips together over an undisclosed record of slights and ringing her little crystal bell for Abigail to come in and clear. The girl came in bearing a steaming jam pudding in a basin.
"Is Colonel Wheaton's house very imposing?" asked Beatrice. She thought she might faint from the addition of steam to a room devoid of oxygen. Mrs. Turber got up with some difficulty and went to the sideboard to cut two slabs of pudding.
"I only went once, when the poor captain was still alive," she said. "A meeting of the aldermen. Lovely it was, and Lady Emily admired my hat very much," she sighed. "Of course, no one wants to invite a poor widow."
"I think it's mostly the governors of the school," said Beatrice.
"Oh, yes, it's just the governors, or just the aldermen, or just the Corson Club and their wives," said Mrs. Turber. "I told Mr. Puddlecum it's enough to make one consider marrying, just to make them come up with better excuses."
Beatrice looked down at the tablecloth and closed her eyes against the image of Mrs. Turber offering such a suggestion to the departed former Latin master.
"I am not looking forward to it," said Beatrice. "It'll be awful to be stared at."
"Well, to be grateful is to show proper humility," said Mrs. Turber.
"I hope you don't want anything else. Only it would be a shame to keep the girl from her afternoon off."
In the warm afternoon, Beatrice again walked the road out of town, up the hill, to Agatha Kent's house, and reflected on how quickly it had become a familiar way, and how comfortable the small town already seemed. It was no doubt some effect of sunshine, and of the breeze, which always held a hint of salty marsh grass. She had told Mrs. Turber she did not relish the coming attention, but now, striding forth, she felt such energy to begin her new life and vocation that she could not wait to join the party. She found Mrs. Kent and her two nephews waiting for her in the cool hallway. "We will watch for one or two carriages to go by and then stroll over at a leisurely pace to the party," said Agatha, straightening her hat in the hall mirror. It was quietly new, of an expensive, glossy dark straw with a moderate circumference, and with a wide navy and white-striped grosgrain ribbon finished with a neat rosette to one side. "Lady Emily has charged us to be early, but she cannot expect us to be premature." She gave a last brush to her suit, which was not, to Beatrice's eye, quite as new, but was of thick linen, carefully pressed and bearing fresh strips of ribbon around the cuffs to match the new hat. It was the kind of suit bought to be used for many years, its skirt let in or out, embellishments stitched on or carefully unpicked as fashions changed, and every autumn laid away in a trunk with a sachet of dried orange peel, lavender and cloves to keep out the moths. Her own cotton dress felt insubstantial and girlish by comparison.
"A stuffy marquee and sticky lemonade is hardly the way to spend such a glorious afternoon," said Daniel. "I hope we'll be able to creep away."
"If you attempt to flee, I will be forced to tell your Uncle John that in his absence you propose the flipping of a coin to decide who should escort us," said Agatha, pulling on white lace gloves.
"But, Aunt Agatha, that's what you keep Hugh around for," said Daniel. "You know he has the better manners." "You are such a child," said Hugh. "You always complain about going, and then you and Harry Wheaton are always the last to be dragged away from the champagne tent."
"I assure you, Miss Nash, that Lady Emily's garden party is always quite lovely and is considered one of the highlights of the summer," said Agatha. "And the garden, while impossibly French, offers wonderful coastal views."
"I hope, Miss Nash, that my aunt has some time allotted for garden viewing and lemonade," added Hugh. "Though I fear Lady Emily and she plan to keep you busy with a campaign of introductions."
"You must each keep one eye on us, boys," said their aunt. "When I raise a brow, you must come and rescue poor Miss Nash."
"I'm very fond of garden parties," said Beatrice. "People are usually so pleasant out of doors." The two young men seemed to find this statement amusing. Even Agatha Kent smiled at her. "The worthies of Rye are much more pleasant out of doors, chiefly because one has more room to manoeuvre away from them," said Daniel. "If I were you, I would keep the gates in view at all times and be prepared to run." "Well, now that you have demolished any hope Miss Nash might have had of a pleasant afternoon, shall we be getting along?" asked Hugh. "May I?"
He offered Beatrice his arm, and they followed Daniel and Agatha out from the cool hall and into the sun-dappled afternoon. The home of Colonel Wheaton and Lady Emily was not the weathered country seat that Beatrice had expected. Walking through elaborate iron gates, she was presented with an abruptness of red brick, a tall edifice of a house with its edges and principal features all piped, like cake icing, with elaborate white stonework. Two footmen in button jackets and two maids in crisp caps and starched aprons stood sentinel on a smoothly raked gravel forecourt. The forecourt, in turn, was edged in symmetrical box-beds, each clipped to geometric perfection and carpeted with a bright pattern of bedding plants. Severely pollarded lime trees stood in rows along the perimeters of the property.
"What do you think of the Wheaton country cottage?" asked Hugh.
"It is very grand," said Beatrice, trying to be non-committal.
"The Colonel has extensive interest in the French brandy business," said Agatha. "The house is designed in a thoroughly French style." "Heaven forbid that the lines of its beauty be softened and blurred under the pressures of English rain or herbaceous fecundity," said Daniel.
"There's no need to be droll, Daniel," said his aunt. "Lady Emily is allowed her taste." But from the way she smiled, Beatrice thought that Agatha Kent was enjoying an unworthy moment of satisfaction, that Lady Emily's money and position did not mean she had superiority of taste. The Wheaton's garden could not be anything but a felicitous scene. The emerald of the lawn, the tightly pitched white marquee made festive with strings of pale blue pennants. The hats, like the heads of summer flowers, nodding above the ladies' linen and cotton dresses. The uniformed servants of small navy ferried trays of sandwiches and buckets of ice across a green sea, and the entire scene was sharply outlined by afternoon sun and teasingly ruffled by a light breeze. Beatrice's heart lifted, and she allowed her jaw to let go its determined clench as she smiled. Some couples were strolling about the stone-walled perimeter of the lawn, but many of the assembled guests had gathered under the slightly steamy heat of the marquee. It was a human condition, Beatrice had often noticed, to hurry under any roof or protective wall, even when the weather was perfect and no danger threatened.
"There you are! We were about to send a search party," called Lady Emily, who was waving her sunshade from her spot at the edge of the marquee. "We are all waiting to meet Miss Nash."
With these words, Beatrice felt herself subjected to the bold scrutiny of dozens of faces, all turning in her direction. The buzz of conversation fell a note, and then rose in intensity, and she concentrated on trying to keep the fleeting sense of lightness, breathing more slowly in and out, trying to rise above a small wave of panic that threatened to make her falter. A hand steadied her elbow, and Hugh Grange, frowning, steered her discreetly behind Agatha and Daniel so that they might traverse the swath of grass between terrace and tent in the protective cover of Agatha's broad back and large, plain sunshade.
"They are not a bad lot," said Hugh. "I think you'll like the headmaster. He always lent me books from his library in the summers. He understands boys very well, and he collects moths."
"Thank you," said Beatrice, her throat dry.
"The usual prominent families," he added. "I'm afraid they can be quite long-winded about the old family history if you give them the slightest opening." "Hugh, we should have a bet as to who manages to communicate the most dazzling ancient connections to Miss Nash," said Daniel over his shoulder.
"Daniel, do behave," said Agatha Kent, moving forward and attempting to embrace Lady Emily without disturbing either of their hats.
"So lovely of you to invite us, dear Emily." "Bettina Fothergill is up to something," said Lady Emily in her abrupt way. "I don't know what it is yet, but she's cooing like a dove."
She glared across the marquee, and Beatrice tried to follow her glance as unobtrusively as possible. It was not hard to spot the portly figure of the town's mayor, who had chosen to wear his chain of office with garden party flannels. Beatrice assumed the thin woman on his arm must be the much-discussed Mrs. Fothergill. She was dressed in a narrow mustard linen suit and was using her free hand to steady an enormous green straw hat covered in red velvet cherries. When she caught sight of Lady Emily and Agatha Kent staring, she let go of the hat momentarily to offer a smile and a wave that was more a wriggle of the fingers.
"Good heavens, she came as a tree," said Agatha, waving back.
"Oh, I think she was going for the whole orchard," said Daniel.
"She brought some nephew of a cousin with her," said Lady Emily.
They all contemplated the young man in a tight, striped blazer who was leaning in to listen to the mayor speak, an action which seemed unnecessary given the prominent size of the young man's ears.
"Some sort of law clerk. I didn't really pay attention."
"That is much the best policy," said Agatha. "Let's ignore her as long as possible. I really want to introduce Miss Nash to one or two people."
"Well, here comes our dear headmaster," said Lady Emily. "He is in a hurry to make sure you are just as ordered."
A kind-faced man in crumpled beige linen was carving a determined path between the guests.
"Or maybe he's just after that book with the colour plates that you failed to return to him last summer," said Daniel, digging Hugh in the ribs.
"Good heavens, you're right," said Hugh. "I entirely forgot."
"If you ladies will excuse us," said Daniel, "I had better take my cousin out of harm's way and leave you to your introductions."
"Headmaster! How delightful to see you in holiday dress," said Agatha.
The headmaster wore a slightly crushed straw fedora and a cravat tucked into his shirt. He looked, thought Beatrice, exactly like a headmaster on a summer tour of Europe's antiquities. He shifted his shoulders as if feeling the phantom weight of missing academic robes.
"May I introduce Miss Nash?"
"'Wonderful of Lady Emily to have arranged for us all to meet in such relaxed circumstances, Miss Nash,' he said, shaking Beatrice's hand. "'One is more at ease outside one's formal setting.'
"'I am grateful to you for giving me this opportunity,' said Beatrice. "'I hope to justify your faith in me.'
"'Have you met our staff?' asked the headmaster.
He waved a hand towards a small group hovering on the edge of the crowd. A young woman with a lace sunshade and a ruffled silk dress of pink and green panels was chatting to a woman of more indeterminate age, who wore a dark, narrow hat and had added a stiff white collar and cuffs to a dark blouse. An older man in a dusty, black jacket was holding forth to a hearty man with a large moustache and striped flannels, strained at the shoulders from a muscular build.
"'Mr. Dobbins, our most senior master, is mathematics,' said the headmaster, pointing. "'Mr. Dimbley is gymnastics and science. Miss Clover is French, and Miss Devon is English, history and sewing.'
"'I am eager to meet them and to visit the school,' said Beatrice.
"'Well, we must arrange something,' said the headmaster, but he made no move to lead her over to make introductions, and Beatrice found she was not at all in a hurry to join her ill-at-ease colleagues. "'Of course, right now we are in the process of our annual fumigation,' he added.
"'What a fine excuse for any circumstance,' said Agatha. "'Headmaster, you are quite the wit this afternoon.' Under the tent, Beatrice felt a headache tightening its iron band around her brow. She had been introduced to so many people that they had all blurred together. She was asking a servant about the relative merits of the lemonade and the fruit punch, hoping for a brief moment in which no one would ask her another penetrating question about her family or her qualifications.
"'I recommend the lemonade,' said a voice, and she turned to find Hugh Grange at her elbow. "'You must be tired of introductions,' he added.
"'Everyone has been very kind,' she said. "'But it is a lot of people to remember.'
"'How did you find the headmaster?' asked Hugh.
"'We talked about exterminating vermin,' said Beatrice. "'He assured me that they fumigate the school after every term to keep the infestations to an acceptable minimum.'
"'I expect that was of great comfort,' said Hugh.
"'Not really,' said Beatrice. "'He said Miss Devon would show me how to sew little bags of sulphur into my hems, to deter lice.'
"'Ah, the realities of modern education,' said Hugh.
"'Your cousin was right about the importance of family history in the town,' said Beatrice. "'Some of your neighbours managed to slip in several centuries of family deeds.'
"'And did you meet Mrs. Fothergill?' he said.
"'Mrs. Fothergill, I will not soon forget,' said Beatrice. "'She quoted Latin at me, and then appeared very surprised when I replied. "'She seems to think I was hired to teach a language I don't know.
"'My understanding is that after Mr. Puddlecombe, the upper grade's Latin teacher left quite suddenly. "'The gymnastics teacher, Mr. Dimbley, had to fill in, and he's a great chap for football and rope-climbing, "'but I believe he couldn't write a word.' And will be relieved to have the classics taken away from him.
Mrs. Fothergill's nephew, Mr. Poot, also speaks Latin, but at least he had the manners not to do so, she said. Mrs. Fothergill was at pains to tell Lady Emily how fortunate it will be for both her nephew and Harry Wheaton to have suitable companionship in the neighbourhood.
I can't wait to tell Daniel, said Hugh. He will be delighted to know that Bettina Fothergill thinks us delinquent.
"'She is quite the least pleasant woman I have met today,' said Beatrice, despite the fact that she could not seem to keep from smiling.
"'Did you meet Lady Emily's daughter, Eleanor, yet?'
asked Hugh.
He pointed to where a young woman with a pale oval face and coils of shimmering fair hair had retired to a wicker chaise under a large tree.
She was elaborately attired in a blinding white ensemble of cotton lawn and a tool-covered hat the size of a cartwheel. Behind her, in deep and cool-looking shade, a severely attired nanny rocked a perambulator so enormous that Beatrice would not have been surprised to find it required a small horse to move it.
"'She is married to a German baron,' added Hugh.
"'Perhaps you would introduce us,' said Beatrice. "'She is such a confection that I suppose I am a bit unsure of myself. Is she as grand as she is beautiful?'
"'If she tries to be,' "'Just ask her about the time Daniel and I had to fish her out of the canal as a child,' said Hugh.
She was always a great scamp, and we make it a point not to let her play the Baroness around us.
The afternoon was going just as planned, but Agatha Kent was beginning to crave one of the large French eclairs that were arranged on an ornate three-tiered stand in the middle of the snowy table piled with silver trays of delicacies. Shiny chocolate glaze dewed with moisture, suggesting the chilled cream within, fleshy crusts barely tinted by their brief turn in the oven. Agatha wondered if she might allow herself just one in celebration of how smoothly Miss Nash's introductions had unfolded. It was a satisfaction, as the wife of an important civil servant, to prove one's subtle skills of influence. In a mood of gracious victory, she looked about her for an empty chair at one of the many small wrought-iron tables, and, seeing only one, she gathered her skirts with one hand and made her way over to where Bettina Fothergill was seated with her nephew. "May I sit down with you, dear Bettina?" she asked. "Only I am in desperate need of some tea." Mrs. Fothergill, who had three finger sandwiches, two chicken aspics, and a separate plate containing a large piece of fruit cake, smiled while dabbing a napkin to her lips. The nephew rose slowly to pull out a chair. "But of course you look exhausted," said Bettina. "This is my sister's son, Charles Poot. Charles, do run along so that Mrs. Kent and I may have a pleasant tete-a-tete." "At once," he said, picking up his plate and almost bowing his waistcoat into his egg sandwich. Agatha disliked him immediately, not for his ears, but for his air of oily cooperation. She could not imagine Daniel or Hugh receiving any such peremptory order from her without a suitably defiant remark. "A cup of tea and just some plain bread and butter," said Agatha to the footman. The eclair, she decided with a sigh, would have to be foregone, as to eat one in front of Bettina Fothergill would be a weakness, and Bettina was prone to pounce on weakness like a weasel on a frog. "Your Miss Nash seems a very pleasant girl," said the mayoress. "Perhaps not of the age and experience that some governors had been expecting," she added. "And, if anything, too qualified for our poor little educational efforts," she continued to exude a smugness that Agatha found almost as nauseating as the green straw hat. "She is very well qualified, and we are lucky to have found her," said Agatha firmly. "The headmaster is quite content in his new appointment." "I'm sure he is," said Bettina, and sighed. "Any whispers of discontent are only that, the merest of whispers." "I believe the headmaster has made an excellent decision," said Agatha. "Of course, one always desires to stand firmly behind the headmaster," said Bettina, gazing with fondness at a cucumber sandwich. "Though technically, you do remember that the governors may exercise a right of approval." "So I have been reminded several times this afternoon." Agatha concentrated on breathing silently in, to the limits of her corset. The footman brought her tea, and for once she welcomed the fussing about, the setting down of the elegant porcelain cup and saucer, and the careful aligning of the small plate of bread and butter. "Is there something I should know, Bettina?"
"I wouldn't presume to say," said the mayoress. "Unlike you and dear Lady Emily, I was not appointed to the Board of Governors."
The school's board was legally required to appoint two female members. In a marvellous sleight of hand, Colonel Wheaton, who chaired the board, had suggested that husbands and wives should not serve together, and then, after Agatha had been confirmed, he had neatly removed himself from the board in favour of his wife, leaving Mayor Fothergill to face the wrath of his own wife.
"Perhaps you should ask Miss Nash to attend the governor's meeting, just in case they wish to examine your choice further," she added.
Then she gathered her skirts, and sacrificing her plate of delicacies for the thrill of the victory, she bid Agatha good day and tottered away across the trodden-down grass. Eleanor Wheaton's skin was as white as if she had come from a sanitarium, and her dress, viewed from a close angle, was of a quality and subtle sheen that suggested costliness. Her hair was piled in intricate curls, but she carried her head with great ease. She would not have been out of place at a royal garden party, thought Beatrice, and was almost more dressed than even the grandeur of her family home could endure.
"Eleanor, may I present Miss Nash, said Hugh. No doubt you will have heard all about her.
How do you do? Said Eleanor, inclining her head before turning to Hugh to add, Your cousin has yet to come over and see me. He and Harry are drinking all the champagne, and as you can see, no one has thought fit to bring me any. Fräulein and I are quite parched, are we not, Fräulein?
She leaned towards the nanny and added, in the loud voice reserved by the English for speaking to foreigners in any part of the world,
Wir sind parched, nicht wahr?
My goodness, your German is appalling, said Hugh. What have you been doing all year?
I would tell you, but I may faint at any moment. Do bring Fräulein and me some refreshment. I implore you.
I'll be right back, said Hugh, jogging off towards the marquee. Beatrice wished she had asked for another cup of lemonade, but she did not like to call after him.
Miss Nash, this is Fräulein Goethe.
Goethe, das ist Miss Nash, said Eleanor, with the bored air of one used to the flow of smooth and unimportant social niceties.
Freut mich, Sie kennen zu lernen, said Beatrice.
The nanny nodded her head and broke into a smile that transformed her from stone to apple-cheeked youthfulness.
Ganz meinerseits, she replied. You speak German, said Eleanor.
Her blue eyes flashed interest at once, and she threw off her air of boredom as she smiled widely.
Oh, my goodness, perhaps you were sent to save me. I have been struggling like the devil to pick it up, but Fräulein speaks no English at all, and it is too exhausting to be always throwing myself across a chasm of understanding.
I expect your husband is fluent in both languages, asked Beatrice.
Yes, he is, damn him, and he seems to think it should be easy for me to do the same, said Eleanor. Now, do sit down here beside me and tell me, do you think it at all reasonable for him to accept a summons home and leave me surrounded by a German staff who speak no English?
I have often found that necessity does make one pick up languages a little faster, said Beatrice. She sank cautiously into a canvas deck chair.
I once had to lease an apartment in Cairo. Yes, yes, said Eleanor, tossing her beautiful head and threatening to dislodge her hat. But could he have at least engaged a bilingual nanny or lady's maid? No, Fräulein Goethe and Liesel the maid are from families who have served his family for centuries, and the Baron's family only has one way of doing things.
Here she assumed a slightly deeper voice and wagged a finger at herself. She crossed her eyes while doing so, and Beatrice could not help laughing.
I hear your husband is young and handsome, and that you are both very much in love, said Beatrice, who had heard the same whispered by several admiring matrons during the afternoon. Oh, he is besotted, and I have him twined around this little finger of mine, said Eleanor. But on this one issue, he is immovable because his mother insists I cannot be presented at court until I have enough German to answer, should their imperial majesties stoop to speak to me. She sighed and kicked off her white, heeled shoes onto the grass. With 2,000 people circulating in the most complicated of processions, I would be lucky if a footman asked for my wrap. Oh dear, said Beatrice, trying not to grin. And so I am confined to making little signs and pointing like a blind person, Eleanor complained, leaning down to massage toes encased in white silk stockings. Beatrice was not quite sure about the analogy, but she lost her train of thought as she saw Hugh coming across the grass, bearing with him not only Daniel but also Harry Wheaton and a footman with many glasses carried on a tray with legs.
We weren't sure what everyone would want to drink, so we brought everything, said Harry Wheaton, his face as innocent and unself-conscious as that of a spaniel puppy. As a footman set the tray table next to Eleanor's chair, Beatrice stood up to make a hasty withdrawal, but Wheaton forestalled her.
I say, Eleanor, I made an absolute donkey of myself insulting Miss Nash the other day, and I beg you to help me make my apologies.
Did you really, Harry? Said his sister. Well, you may have to leave immediately, because if Miss Nash is not of a mind to forgive you, I'm afraid I must choose her over you. She is going to teach me German.
Really, it was nothing, said Beatrice. But I should find Mrs. Kent, if you'll excuse me.
But we will certainly not excuse you, said Eleanor. We will have my oath of a brother removed by several footmen. Do pass me some champagne, Daniel.
Miss Nash,
I really do apologize, most sincerely, said Wheaton. Do stay and have a glass of champagne, or have a glass of lemonade, as I intend to do. He picked up a glass of lemonade, causing his sister and Daniel to go off into peals of laughter.
I forgive you, Mr. Wheaton, said Beatrice, if only for the sake of your mother, who has been so kind to me, and your sister, who is so charming.
I am often so forgiven, he said. I will drink this lemonade in their honour, and promise to be a better man hereafter.
Good, said Eleanor. Now Beatrice can sit down, and we can all be comfortable while Daniel reads us some of his poems.
The footman offered lemonade and champagne, and Beatrice took the lemonade and promised herself it would be the last time.
I'm an invited guest, not the entertainment, said Daniel. I only show my poems on the most serious of occasions.
You used to show me one for a penny, said Eleanor. I have a whole box of ditties tied up with a tartan ribbon from my 12th birthday.
I was less discriminating in those days, said Daniel. Discrimination being less affordable when one is a small boy with no pocket money.
As the talk ebbed and flowed, Hugh pulled up a deck chair and Daniel sprawled on the grass with no regard for his light flannel trousers. Harry Wheaton perched on the end of his sister's chaise, and there was talk of a picnic expedition to the hop fields and of the new bathing machines at Camber Sands. And then Eleanor was expressing a wish that Beatrice accompany her to bathe, as neither Fräulein nor the maid enjoyed the water, and had made such a fuss last time. Beatrice, pleased to be still and cool and among this laughing circle of young people as the shadows lengthened across the lawn, felt for a moment released from care, and repeated to herself that it had been a happy decision to come to Rye. When the time came to leave, Agatha Kent seemed distracted, and was still looking about her after she, her nephews and Beatrice, had already taken their farewells of Lady Emily. "There he is," said Agatha, and waved her sunshade quite rudely at the headmaster, who seemed to be slipping away down a side path. The headmaster changed direction and came to say goodbye.
"Lovely afternoon," he said.
"We have been looking for you everywhere," said Agatha. "You have been positively elusive."
"I have been looking for you, too," said the headmaster. "Quite impossible in the crush, of course."
The small group of guests remaining on the large lawn did not seem to Beatrice to qualify as a crush, and Agatha's pursed lips suggested she thought the same.
"Mrs. Fothergill seems to be under the extraordinary impression that Miss Nash should appear at the governor's meeting tomorrow," said Agatha. "I am sure she meant no offence to your independence and judgment, headmaster, but I did suggest it would be the height of rudeness to suggest any debate of your decision in such matters."
"I appreciate your support, Mrs. Kent," said the headmaster.
He looked uncomfortable around the neck and pulled at his collar.
"I do hope my letter to you, Miss Nash, indicated that a final approval of our Board of Governors was usual."
"And usually automatic," added Agatha.
"Quite so," said the headmaster. "And it seems to me that Miss Nash has little to fear from any last-minute candidate."
"So there is a candidate," said Agatha.
"Quite sudden and unexpected," said the headmaster. "I assure you, I did not suggest nor promote the young man in question, but it has been argued persuasively that, should we deny the board a chance to hear from all parties, we may be open to criticism at a later date."
"Bettina Fothergill's work?" said Agatha.
"Is it that weaselly-looking nephew of hers?" said Daniel. "He had the audacity to ask me where I purchased my tie, and I don't think he meant it as a compliment."
"That's it," said Agatha. "For once you are perspicacious, Daniel."
"Are you suggesting I am usually a fool?" said Daniel.
"Of course, in the event of an unforeseen decision in the unfavourable direction," said the headmaster, smoothly refusing to engage in answering the question, "I will make myself personally responsible to return Miss Nash to her family entirely unburdened by any travel expenses. So there is no need to worry at all, young lady."
He smiled widely and patted Beatrice on the arm. She fought against the urge to push him to the ground. Agatha took her other arm and pressed it firmly.
"We shall see you at tomorrow's meeting, and Lady Emily and I will rely on your continued support," she said.
We must not tolerate underhanded machinations.
Not unless we instigate them, of course, Beatrice heard Daniel whisper to Hugh.
We must do something to help Aunt Agatha, Hugh.
She could not help but admire and despair of the family loyalty expressed in his urgent tone, which only highlighted her own lack of any family to stand with her.
I am sure it is all quite a formality, the headmaster was saying, but it was not within my power to refuse.
I think I would like to go home now, said Beatrice faintly, the pleasures and potential pleasures of the conjured afternoon falling away like so many blowing ashes. As she allowed Hugh to lead her away, she gathered up a few thoughts of the lovelier parts of the afternoon and stowed them away in the back of her mind, where they might remind her, at some future date, that lovely afternoons do not survive the chill of dusk.
Chapter 6 Despair had a way of making tea taste bad. Beatrice recognized the feeling and knew that the ladies' parlour of the finest coaching inn along the high street was probably not as drab as it appeared to her at this moment. The white wainscoting seemed bright enough, and fresh flowers adorned a low table in front of the fireplace, but the floral upholstery of the chairs made her dizzy, and the sun, lancing in at tall courtyard windows, was painful to her eyes. A sleepless night counting and recounting her small stock of money had left her feeling weak. By no creative arrangement or stringent budgeting could she contrive to manage independently on the small allowance under her control. She might have managed abroad, in some small French town perhaps, but her father's family would never advance her the funds to establish herself, and she had no intention of humiliating herself by asking. In the dark, she had considered writing again to those American friends of her father to whom she had already written, thanking them for their condolences. There had been expressions of concern and support on their part, and perhaps she had been too elliptical in her replies. But in the pale hours of the dawn, she knew she had been clear in her expression of a desire for meaningful work and a productive life. She had all but asked them to find her a position. Only two had found it necessary to reply again, and both carefully worded letters had extolled the virtue of home and reminded her of her father's dying wish to see her safe in the bosom of his family. She had declined one other teaching offer in favour of Rye. A northern mill town had offered just the productive life, the challenge of public service, that she craved. But her heart had failed her at the thought of soot-blackened streets and rows of tenement cottages running across the hills. She had been forced to laugh at her own hypocrisy in choosing seaside Sussex over the surely greater educational impact she might make among the children of factory workers. Now she wondered if she would have time to write again and ask them to reconsider her. If not, she might eke out a few weeks at a friend's home near Brighton, but her chances of finding some other position immediately were not good. She had no romantic notions of becoming a parlour maid or an actress, and she had never had patience with those more literary heroines who solved their problems with a knife or an oncoming train. She would have to write to Marbley Hall at some point and ask to come back.
"Excuse me, miss," said a serving girl, peering around the door. "They're ready for you in the green banqueting hall."
"Thank you," said Beatrice, rising reluctantly from her chair. She shook out her skirts and smoothed a hand across her hair, looking at her face in the overmantel mirror. She would face the Board of Governors with her very best smile and a forthright presentation of her skills and qualifications. She would not let them see that she knew the answer was already decided. They would pick the man over her, but she would make sure they knew in their hearts that she was the better candidate. Hugh and Daniel were hovering outside the coaching inn, which presented an August Georgian facade to the high street and was the site of many a municipal meeting and festivity. Or rather, as Hugh acknowledged, he was hovering, conspicuous in his anxiety, while Daniel leaned against the inn's front wall, smoking a cheroot, and gazing upward in the annoying way he did when he was suddenly struck by some fortunate arrangement of words. Hugh could only hope he would not start pulling out his notebook and a pen when time was so precious.
"He said he'd be here,"
said Daniel, still musing.
I do wish you'd stop fidgeting. And Harry Wheaton is the most reliable man we know, said Hugh.
He is most reliable when there's a prank to be played, or a girl to be courted, said Daniel. He seemed to regard the removal of Mr. Poot as a lark.
Well, Poot is sitting in the hallway now, and Miss Nash is already in with the governors, said Hugh. We should go and talk to him ourselves.
Poot? Asked Daniel.
What would we say? Could you please withdraw so our aunt can beat your aunt?
We have to do something, said Hugh.
While Daniel and Harry had agreed that Bettina Fothergill could not be allowed to usurp both Aunt Agatha and Lady Emily with her machinations, Hugh found himself unusually indignant at the unfairness of Mr. Poot snatching away a job from a young woman who so clearly deserved it. As he peered through the inn's open door again, to where Mr. Poot sat very straight on a wooden settle, looking like a skinny Toby jug, he reassured himself that ordinary chivalry demanded action, and that his indignation had more to do with Miss Nash being alone in the world than with a pretty face or the intelligence behind her eyes.
"Oh, for goodness sake! He'll see you," said Daniel. "We're trying to be discreet, remember?"
Just then, an automobile horn gave a loud blast, and a large black car swerved to a halt with Wheaton, attired in a voluminous duster and goggles, at the wheel. The chauffeur rode next to him, tight-lipped and gripping the door.
"Am I on time?" called Wheaton.
He removed his goggles, wiped his face with a driving scarf, and hopped out of the car. The chauffeur slid over to take the wheel.
"We dropped off my mother earlier, and I took the old car for a spin. Still getting the hang of it. Round the corners, it's like trying to steer a cow."
"Ridden many cows?" asked Daniel.
"A few," said Wheaton. "At least that's what they tell me. I can't say I remember clearly."
"We are too late," said Hugh. "Miss Nash is already being interviewed, and they may send for Poot at any time."
"Well, we'd better get to work," said Wheaton.
"Daniel and I will lure Poot into the tap room, while you slip your aunt a note and ask her to stall as long as possible."
Hugh hung back as they entered the inn's lobby and asked a porter to bring him a pen and paper. He took a seat at a small table in a window nook and busied himself with turning over the pages of an old issue of the Racing Times. Trying to appear absorbed in tables of results from early spring's races and advertisements for stud services and worm treatments, he kept a keen ear on Wheaton's conversation.
"Just telling my friend Daniel here that this town is sorely lacking in congenial chaps on whom one can rely for a companionable talk."
"I tell him he's too fussy about where he gathers," said Daniel, shaking Poot by the hand.
"I don't like rubbing up against all and sundry," said Wheaton.
"I prefer a quiet room and a landlord who knows his regulars. Don't you agree, Pooty, old boy?"
"It's just Poot," said Poot.
"Have you met old Jones, the landlord here?" asked Wheaton,
stuffing his driving gloves into his coat pocket and shouldering off the voluminous garment. A footman stepped smoothly up to take it from him. Wheaton was well known in half the public houses in town, and while most had had occasion to escort him off the premises for some wild act stemming from drunkenness, they never failed to welcome him with a hopeful deference.
"I have not had occasion," began Poot.
He looked ready to deny any desire to frequent public houses, but Wheaton interrupted.
"What luck," he said.
"Daniel and I were just stopping in now to ask Jones about hosting a small supper for a few chaps. Come with us, and I'll introduce you."
"Oh, I couldn't. I'm waiting to see the school governors," said Poot.
But Hugh saw his eyes flicker towards the tap room.
"That could take hours, no, my mother," said Wheaton.
He slapped Poot heartily on the back.
"You come along with us, and we'll ask old Jones to give us a nod when they need you upstairs."
"When Harry Wheaton introduces you, you're all set in this town," said Daniel, steering him by the arm now. "It's a good thing we came along."
As they disappeared into the tap room, Hugh looked around for someone to take up his note. It took a few moments to find a man and to give him instructions and fish out a sixpence to thank him. When the note was safely on its way upstairs, Hugh shuffled slowly past the taproom door and glanced in to see Mr. Jones, the landlord, lead a toast to the king, and a nervous Mr. Poot, earlobes scarlet, drink down his glass in one swallow. His eyes closed as if in prayer, but his face did not twist or pucker, as might be usual in someone unused to strong drink. Of the four men gathered around the bar, only Daniel gave a smothered cough as the dram went down.